We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Murtaza Hussain, he is a reporter with The Intercept, and we are talking about the piece, Christie's Conspiracy, Terror Plot of the Fort Dix Five. Welcome to the program, Murtaza.
Thank you for having me.
I got to tell you, I remember reporting this in 2007, and at the time it was, there was a rash of these things. It, Christie wasn't necessarily out front as much as, or at the time I was just, I guess, not as conscious of Chris Christie, and didn't realize the implications of this case in terms of his political career. And I do recall, and I think this was the case, although it didn't come up in your piece, that there was a story of perhaps that it had to do with, there was an attempt that they needed uniforms or something, or boots or something like that. But I don't know if that was the same case. But I got to tell you, I read this piece, and it is enraging.
Yeah, it was truly one of the more shocking, as well as high-profile post-9/11 terrorism convictions or prosecutions in the U.S. I remember when the story first broke, I also found it to be a bit strange because the way it was reported was that a group of Albanian pizza delivery guys had tried to attack the base where they normally deliver pizza. That had kind of been the gist of it in the media. And then it kind of disappeared, and that was bizarre on its own, and then they were sentenced to life in prison, and the case went away. But, it always stood out to people who have examined it in greater detail as one of the most, egregious cases of the use of informants to manufacture terrorism. And also the fact that these guys, they didn't actually go along with the informant in this case. The vast majority of them didn't even know about the plot they were eventually convicted of and sentenced to life in prison for.
Yeah, it's stunning. Before we get into the actual story, because I want to go, I mean, the story is, and you've done a great job with Razan Galani. Am I saying his name right?
Yeah, sorry.
And why did you guys decide to look into this case? I mean, this is a case from 2000, well, I guess it was 2000. Was it 2008 or 2007, I should say, is when they got arrested. The case was in 2008. They've been in jail for some time. What made you dig into this now?
Well, we'd gotten to know the Duca family a bit because they're plugged in this community of people who have been, targeted for post-9/11 terrorism convictions. There's an organization called No Separate Justice, which tracks the many of these cases. So from there, it stood out that, this is a case which has been highlighted as being particularly egregious. And, there are so many cases out there, but what was different in this case is that we had access, through the lawyer to the family, to a lot of the trial transcripts, to the actual evidence documentation that was used against them. So we were able to do a deep dive. It was sort of a circumstance where we had the ability to do it, where in many other cases that documentation is just not available. So, that's kind of how it got going, because of the fact we had the opportunity. And through The Intercept, though, we had, the resources and the time allotted to us to really spend a few months looking into it.
Yeah, it's an amazing piece. All right, so let's start going through this. Ultimately, the subjects of your piece are members of the Duca family. Who are they, and how did they tell us just a little bit about how they came to this country?
The Duca family they're ethnic Albanians from Macedonia, and they left Macedonia during the period of the end of communism, the collapse of former Yugoslavia. And they came to the United States as undocumented immigrants. They took a train across Europe to Italy, lived in a refugee camp, and they crossed to Mexico and crossed from there. And then they ended up in Brooklyn. And, they were this quintessential American immigrant story whereby they started off in Brooklyn, hardscrabble beginnings, these working class immigrants working in grocery stores and food delivery and things like this, and they kind of worked them their way up, and they saved money and they moved out to suburban Cherry Hill, New Jersey, which is one of the nice suburbs in the East Coast. And, you know, things were going great. And they had growing families. They had five children as well as a bunch of grandchildren. And then suddenly in 2006, everything sort of went wayward when their three brothers were investigated in this terrorism charge, which did not start off as a terrorism investigation. It just started off when they dropped off a home video of themselves at a shooting range in the Poconos where they go on vacation to Circuit City, and the Circuit City clerk got alarmed by these Muslim men, you know, skiing, having snowball fights, and also going to a shooting range in the Poconos. And they contacted the police. The police contacted the FBI. The FBI launched this two-year investigation of them and sent some informants to, you know, sort of infiltrate
their lives. All right, well, we got time to sort of go through some of these beats. I mean, you know, the story is incredibly compelling, and people are going to want to read the piece to flesh it out. But let's follow this, because I think, you know, at the end of this, it tells the story of just how determined the FBI is. Not as I think there's this myth of like, oh, the FBI is determined to get their guy. It is just how determined the FBI is to get any guy. And if they have to make up that guy, they'll make up that guy. So this goes back to 2006. The Duca brothers, there's three of them, right, that we're talking about? Or is it just two involved in the trip?
There were three.
Okay, so there's three kids. And they go with some of their friends, specifically a guy named Mohammed Schnur, who was going to be their future brother-in-law. Is that right?
Yes, he was going to be the future brother-in-law of El Javier Duca, one of the brothers.
And they go to this trip. They take a video of it because they're, you know, just a bunch of guys out in the woods and they're having fun. But part of it is that they're shooting guns, right?
They're skiing, they're riding horses, and they're shooting guns at a public shooting range.
Right. Okay. So there you have it. I mean, fairly typical behavior for people in Pennsylvania. And so what happens? So they bring the tape back. They want to make copies of it. This is back in 2006, where it wasn't necessarily like you shoot it on your flash card, put it into your computer, and you copy the video for everybody. This is actually hard tape, which is, when you contemplate just that fact alone and where these guys end up, is sort of stunning, right? I mean, if this happens 3 years later, they probably don't have a hard copy of the tape. They probably don't need to go to Circuit City to get copies to give to their buddies so that everybody can enjoy it. So what happens once the employee at Circuit City calls the police and the FBI is brought in?
Yeah, it's really such a tragic turn, because their own perception of their behavior was so innocuous, they didn't see anything wrong with taking it to Circuit City and having the tape made. They're just doing a normal thing for their vacation. So the Circuit City clerk sees the tape. He becomes sort of alarmed by these Muslim guys at the shooting range, and then he calls the police. The police call the FBI, and the FBI contacts some of their local informants and asks them to sort of infiltrate the group. And this is in 2006, and they do that. And, you know, right away it becomes clear there's no link to a terrorism group here. There's no link to a terrorist plot. But instead of doing the normal thing, which is, you know, after checking something out and leaving it alone, they keep pushing and pushing and pushing to develop some sort of, you know, criminal conspiracy where there is none. And it's been 2 years and hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars doing this just to generate these charges in a case which didn't exist at the beginning of all this.
All right, so let's go to wait. So when the FBI, okay, they get this, they say, all right, these guys are located in this area near this Circuit City, right, this part of New Jersey. And you make the point in the piece that the FBI now has 15,000 confidential informants around the country. And I would imagine the percentage of those that are Muslim is quite high. And So these are guys. So how did they, I mean, how many informants did they call? How did they, they show up at this guy's house, a guy named Muhammad Omar, right? And
yes.
And they've got pictures of the guys. They, according to Omar, I think it is in the piece, he says, when the FBI comes to your house with a picture, they already know whether or not you know this guy. Is that basically it?
Yeah, that's correct. There's like some suggestion that Omar had worked as an informant previously, and he's familiar with the FBI tactics. And he was like, they showed him a picture of Mohammed Schnur, and he had known Schnur in the sense of he'd shopped at his family's grocery store, or he was familiar with who he was. So they asked him to befriend him and find out what's going on with this guy.
Okay. I mean, and I want to make that point so that people can understand just sort of like how tenuous the connections were here. It's not like they had a list of sleeper cells. It was just like, we know, you know, somebody in the neighborhood and we're going to go to him. And they probably went to several other guys maybe, right? Or they, or potentially just hoping that one of them may have some tenuous connection. And so Omar starts going into the supermarket and just basically, I mean, just chatting this guy up all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So he just came to the supermarket. And Omar, keep in mind, is a lot older than Schnur. Schnur was 22. He was quite young. And you know, from everyone who knows him, he was like particularly immature for a 22-year-old, even so. Omar was almost 40, and, you know, he kind of befriended him. He's this guy who didn't really have a lot of friends and was kind of susceptible to the influence of this much older guy. And he kept coming in, talking to him about politics and the war and all this stuff and trying to feel him out and sort of, like, you know, trying to rile him up a little bit, too. So this was sort of the pathway to introduce Omar into the lives of not just Schnur, but also the Duker brothers, who, as you mentioned, were related to Schnur by marriage.
And so, and so, how does Omar get Schnur into this conversation about sort of like we should do something? Because this is sort of like the nexus, right? Schnur is trying to impress Omar, and Omar is starting to say to Schnur, like, you know, all this stuff that's going on in the world, we should do something about it, right?
Yeah, exactly. It took many months to sort of get that point, but Omar had always had, I'm sorry, Schnur had always kind of wanted to show people that he was also a tough guy. Even when the Dukas, he'd tell them stories about when he'd get into altercations with people who refused to pay the fare in his taxi and how he'd, you know, they get exact violent retribution on them for that. He'd always sort of try to talk himself up, and he was sort of like his young guy who was a big talker. And Omar would try to, you know, see, like, you know, what kind of tough thing are you going to say about this when he's talking about politics, the wars, which, you know, at that time, 2006, people were generally quite upset about. And, you know, he just continued over the course of many months to do this. And then sometime after about August 2006, after many, many months of discussion, they start talking about, you know, it's Fort Dix is over there and we should do something about Fort Dix. And then they start talking about this. Under a conspiracy law, you cannot enter into a conspiracy to convict, to commit a criminal act with an informant, however. So to even get Schnur about this, they'd have to implicate somebody else into this conspiracy. So Schnur knew the Duker brothers. And knew
all right, hold on one second there. I just want to make sure that people understand this point about a conspiracy, because this is really relevant here. Is that, I mean, tell us what the criminal charge of conspiracy is.
So it's a, like for any conspiracy, like in this case, there was a conspiracy to allegedly target and kill U.S. service members at Fort Dix. It's an agreement to commit a criminal act at some point in the future, and you can't enter into such an agreement with a government informant. So at this time, there's only Schnur and the informant Omar talking about doing anything at all. So Omar told him, like, you know, because probably a direction of his handlers, there's no investigation, there's no crime here, just with Schnur saying stuff to you and you goading him along. You have to get some other third party who is not an informant also involved in this. So Omar's just telling him, like, you know, we need to get some other guys into this if this is going to happen. again, this time there's no plot. There's nothing going on other than what's going on with the informant and Schuer. And he's starting to go to him and ask him, you know, can you get some other people involved in this criminal conspiracy? And Schnoor sort of volunteers some other people. He volunteers the Duker brothers. He volunteers another guy named Sardar Tatar without their knowledge and says, yeah, I can get these guys in. I can get them in, no problem.
Let me just read the exchange between Schnoor and Omar that you reprint, I presume, from either transcripts or from actually hearing the tape. Schnoor says, you know Sardar, who has the pizzeria close to here. Now, you can almost hear, at least I can sort of imagine, this 22-year-old kid trying to impress Omar. And so Schnoor says, you know Sardar, who has the pizzeria close to here. And Omar says, so what are your thoughts about him? And Schnoor says, he's ready. He has a map. He used to deliver there. And then Omar says, ready to be killed? And Schnoor says, yes. Now, just the idea, I mean, this is sort of laughable, right? To me, this is sort of laughable. You're just like, oh, yeah, this guy's ready to attack Fort Dix. I mean, if this doesn't end so tragically, this is comedic. It's borderline comedic insofar as, like, this guy's just sort of clearly trying to impress him. Like, oh, yeah, I got a whole gang. Yeah, we've got motorcycles or whatever, you know, whatever it is. I'm sorry. Continue with the thing. It is just amazing to see this stuff. So Omar now must essentially create another agreement between Schnoor and some other people, because that's the only way the conspiracy can exist, because, of course, you know, sort of like contractually, I can't make a contract with someone. I can't have a meeting of minds if this person is fundamentally being fraudulent.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny you should raise, because, like, when we're going through the transcripts too, like, it would be comedic if it not at the end so tragically. It's just so, like, the conversations are just so like, so far from the realm of actual criminality, and, like, so obviously, like, just ridiculous that had they not ended up in jail, it would have been quite funny. So, yeah, essentially, he told him, like, he kept hounding him to find anyone else he could, and at one point, Omar gets really interested in the idea of Eljavir Duka being included, and he asks him over the course of a month, like, almost 200 times, like, what's going on with Eljavir? Have you talked to Eljavir? And Schnoor, of course, like, yeah, I've talked to everyone. Everyone knows about it. And the interesting is, the informant never really believes him, and he even told us this in a piece. And he even said at trial, which sort of, you know, escaped the notice of the judge somehow, that he never actually told me, like, he told me the Dukas are involved, but the Dukas never told me that, and I didn't actually believe they're involved. And I don't think that they ever knew about the Fort Dix plot, because Schnoor was very blatantly sort of lying about it and sort of trying to impress the Omar as he tried to impress the Dukas and about other things. So, you know, like, he just sort of gave him this half-baked conspiracy where half people didn't even know they were involved. And even, Sardar Tatar, who also got 30 years, not life, in this plot, the way he was involved is that, Omar approached him and said, well, I want to do something like this. And he panicked, and he said, he called the police. He told the police that, look, I think this guy is a terrorist, and he's trying to commit a terrorist act. And the guy he was reporting was the FBI informant. And he even recorded him on his cell phone, trying to show, you know, tapes of the recordings to the police. So he say, like, look, this guy might be a terrorist. And somehow he ended up implicated in the plot, too, because right. Omar kept hounding him for this map.
Murtaza, hold on. I want to slow down, because I just want people to be able to digest this. Because so there's sort of four players in this. There is Omar, there's Schnoor. There's Tatar, who was the pizza delivery guy. And then there's the Duka brothers, and there's actually a couple of them. And so Schnoor is basically telling Omar, who is the older guy and who is the FBI informant, is really not even a proper description. This is the sort of the FBI provocateur. It's really sort of more describes what he's doing here, because he's not just informing on anything. He's actually driving this entire thing. And so Omar says to Schnoor, can you get guys? And Schnoor's like, oh, sure, yeah, I can get a bunch of guys. And Omar's like, well, who can you get? And he goes, well, there's this pizza delivery guy I know, and he has the maps. And Omar actually, because Schnur is so ineffectual and really sort of comes off as being sort of almost like afraid to deliver. I mean, this is like the equivalent of like being in, you know, I mean, this reminds me of being in junior high and my friends going like, hey, can you steal that bottle of champagne from your dad's liquor cabinet and bring it out? And it's like, yeah, I'm going to do it this weekend. And the weekend comes and goes, well, I couldn't do it this weekend, but next weekend. And this goes on for a long time. So Omar goes to Tatar, and Tatar actually reports him on multiple occasions to the cops and keeps waiting for the FBI to come because he has a guy who's actually, he thinks, is trying to plot, right? I mean, I'm retelling it properly, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He called the police. Well, Tatar, he also worked in 7-Eleven. And there was a Philadelphia police officer who used to come there every day and have coffee and sort of chat with him. And then one day, you know, after Omar starts approaching him about the terrorism plot, he tells the police officer, you know, look, I got something to tell you. Like, I think this guy I know might be a terrorist. He's trying to do something bad. And, you know, he tries giving him information, and he says, okay, I'll call the FBI, the police officer tells him. And then, you know, it takes 3 weeks for the FBI to show up. In the meantime, Sardar is, like, trying to, you know, ask the police officer what's going on, like, have you talked to anybody? And in that intervening time, Omar is also, like, sort of pounding him and asking for the map and doing all the stuff. And when the FBI guy comes, finally, Tatar tells him about it, and he also shows him, you know, audio recordings he made of Omar to try to, you know, show him that there's some proof. And the FBI officer who testified about it, you know, he even testified that I didn't follow up on it, and I didn't really make much effort to try to discern the validity of these recordings. I just kind of ignored it. And then the next time he saw Tatar was when he was arresting him for allegedly being part of this plot. So Tatar really was, it's just incredible what happened to him. And he kind of got implicated because in the intervening 3 weeks between the time when he first told the police and when the FBI showed up, Omar asked him for a map again and again. One day he gave him the map. And then when the FBI questioned about it, when they showed up, he sort of panicked and said, oh, no, I didn't give him the map. He got scared. And then that's how, you know, he sort of became implicated in this plot. And I think, he got 30 years in jail, which is an incredibly long and punitive sentence. But the judge, who was extremely punitive in this case, he seemed to even recognize that by not giving Tatar life. You know, so I guess it's some sort of leniency.
This is so incredible. So let me ask you this. I'm going to stay on Tatar for a moment. And so Tatar actually goes so far as to make his own recordings as if he's like, I mean, he's that super diligent about turning in this guy who he thinks is a suspected terrorist. I have two questions for you. One is, what happened with that cop? Did that cop not come into the trial proceedings and say, hey, wait a second, I want you to know Tatar came to me, you know, well before this and reported it? Did Tatar's lawyer not bring in that cop, or what happened with that cop?
No, the cop testified. He testified to that at the trial. He testified that Tatar tried to tell me about this. He didn't. And I don't know, like, if you would ask me, like, why that did not factor into the prosecution giving pause, why the prosecution this guy, and why the judge did not also, you know, factor this very glaring fact into his own decision, I'm at a loss. But Dean Dandridge did testify at the trial about Tatar's attempt to turn him in. Not only did he testify about this at the trial, it also came out that, you know, as part of this whole case, it was alleged that these guys went to the Poconos not just to hang out at the shooting range and to ski and stuff, but those are training missions. Well, Tatar actually invited this cop on one of those trips to try to show him Omar and, like, why he thought Omar was, like, sort of questionable. He said, you know, you should come on our next Poconos vacation because you can check the guy out yourself. This all came out at trial, but it was not a barrier to Tatar's conviction somehow. And just like, you know, the Duca is not.
I want to get to the Ducas in a second, but did you interview? Did you interview the detective?
No, we weren't able to get in touch with him. We got his contact information, but he was not. We weren't able to actually make contact with him.
I'd be fascinated to hear, like, what he says at this point about it. Like, I mean, he must, that would be fascinating to me to find out. Like, I mean, he must feel, I would imagine he feels bad or maybe doesn't know what to believe. Because my second question for you is that FBI agent who first comes and speaks to Tatar, in the course of the trial, was there any indication as to whether or not he knew that Tatar was under, I guess, in some ways, surveillance because Omar was working on him?
Well, we don't know if that FBI agent who was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force knew that. But he actually, ironically, the next time he saw Mr. Tatar after that day he tried reporting Omar was when he went to arrest him as part of the 465 arrest. So he was actually involved in both ends of it, involved in Tatar trying to report Omar and involved in Tatar being arrested for the plot.
Okay, so, well, I understand as a reporter, you don't want to make any conclusions that you can't back up. But it would be sort of surprising, I guess, if he had no idea that first time he went to talk to Tatar. I mean, because one would expect if this is a guy who's on the counterterrorism force that when somebody hands him when a would-be informant, which is what Tatar thought he was, right? Tatar thought he was the informant. That when a would-be informant hands you an audio tape of somebody who this would-be informant thinks is trying to commit, is planning a terrorist attack, I would imagine you'd be more engaged unless you had reason to believe that you already sort of knew why about Omar. But let's leave that just sort of hanging in the wind as one of those questions that really it seems to me the government should be answering. But so we have this situation with Tatar. How does the Duca family, how do they get involved in this?
So the Duca family, like as you mentioned, they were related to Schnur or they were, you know, engaged to be related to him by marriage. And, you know, in addition to Tatar, Schnur said, I can get you these Duca brothers involved too. And then Omar is very enthusiastic about this prospect. And he tries to have a meeting to discuss the plot over months and months, which never comes to fruition because the Dukas don't know about the plot. And Omar himself suspects this. So after months of trying and failing to sort of get the Dukas involved and being frustrated in this, suddenly a second informant shows up, a guy named Desnik Bakali. And he was Albanian, and the FBI sort of insinuated him into the lives of the Duca brothers by having him show up at the Dunkin' Donuts they usually hang out with and start talking in Albanian. So he befriends them, and then he shows up and he starts hanging out with them. And, you know, he never raises any 4-6 plot with them over all that surveillance either. He doesn't bring it up, and he even concedes the trial. They didn't seem to know anything about it, but he sort of tries to rile them up into making provocative statements. He pretended to be this guy who would, like, run away from a criminal charge in Albania, and he's trying to straighten his life out with religion and asking a lot of questions about, you know, jihad and stuff, what should we do? And they really took a pity on him because they saw him as this wayward fellow Albanian and tried to help him, even gave him some work in the roofing business and tried to find a wife. So he was really provocateur and trying to get them to make incriminating statements. And we've sweated a lot of these for the video that we did on the brothers, as well as the written piece. And, you know, again, he never gets them to commit to any plot. He just sort of gets them to say things which sound, like, scary or damning in court later on. And he was just a vile sort of provocateur, in addition to the work Omar was doing to try and trap these guys.
So there are now two, quote-unquote, informants who are really far more active than an informant. And at this point, the only person that they sort of, like, I guess, have gotten – you know, well, they haven't quite implicated Tatar, but they will get him on a future lie to federal investigators because he was afraid to admit that he had given over this map to a guy that he was trying to turn in to the FBI. And so, okay, so this new provocateur comes in and starts to sort of, like, I guess, push the Duca brothers. How far does he get? I mean, it's basically just around them wanting to own their own guns.
Yeah, like, he didn't get very far. He, like, we've selected all the like a lot of the transcriptions of their conversation, put them in the piece. Like on one day, he gets Shane to say something, yeah, we can do something with it. He was trying to like, you know, kind of tease them and shame them. Like, you guys are just like wusses, you're not doing anything, women and children being chilled, you're just sitting around. And even that one time where he got Shane to say, not anything but plot, he's like, yeah, I will do something, I'm going to do something. He kept pushing him on it and started getting to follow up, and Shane totally retracts those statements and says, you know, like, no, we're focused on our families and we're not going to do anything, blah, 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 when you look at it seriously. So, you know, just guys, you tell you're just a friend, like, blowing off steam with them. They had no idea he was trying to entrap them and getting them to make incriminating statements. So he didn't really get any really far. He didn't get far at all. Like, the only one who got any traction was Omar with Schnur. So after all this time passes and nothing is really happening, it's been about a year and a half now of the informants in their lives, Omar, who knows the Dukas quite well by this time, he says, you know, like, I can get you some guns, because I know you like guys like going to the shooting range in the Poconos, and I can get you a list of guns, like, very cheaply.
Now, hold on, let me interrupt here. The Duca brothers, and I have to say also, when Shane Duca... you relate what Shane Duca says after this guy Bacali is trying to push him. Shane Duca says, yeah, I'll do something. But then he goes on to talk about how jihad, the first jihad you wage is just a personal jihad. It's really just about piety for this guy. And it's actually sort of like a fairly, you know, sort of moving a thing that he has to say about sort of like your own sort of like morality and passing this on to your children is the biggest sort of way that we can fight this type of stuff. It's actually sort of a pretty nice sentiment. And so jumping ahead to where Omar knows that these guys, when they go on these trips to the Poconos and they go to this public shooting range, because they are still not legal citizens, right? These guys are still are undocumented. Is that right?
Yeah, several of them have been on the path to getting asylum, but they were still undocumented at the time, so they couldn't legally own firearms.
So they couldn't legally own their own firearms, so they had to wait in line to get rentals at the firing range, and so they wanted their own firearms, but of course they could not get those because they were undocumented. So Omar comes and says, I have a guy who can get you some firearms.
Yeah, I can get you the firearms and also very cheaply, so like a fraction of the cost you normally pay. So Shane is like, yeah, okay, I'm interested. And Omar is a friend. They didn't think that anything was amiss about this. He's like, I'm potentially interested. Let me know. So a few weeks later, Omar comes back with a list of firearms that he can get him and the prices. So unbeknownst to Shane, this list was actually made by the FBI. And, this is not Shane, this is Dritan Duca who's talking, this is Tony Duca talking about the list. And so he brings back the list, and there are some pistols and some rifles and the things they normally would take to the Poconos. And then there's also RPGs and M16 machine guns and things which are like military-grade hardware. And Tony tells him, well, you know, like, I don't want any of that stuff. Like, sure, the rifles and pistols are fine, but what's this? And he starts getting concerned, actually, and there's a transcript of this, too, where he says, you know, like, that list you gave me, there was some really hardcore stuff on there, and, like, you know, I was kind of worried about that. I had kids, like, is everything okay with this guy that you're, you know, your friend in Baltimore? Is anything I need to know? No, I was like, no, nothing I need to know. Everything's fine.
Well, it sounds like from the transcript, and I'm trying to find the actual response, it sounds like Duca is almost saying, like, hey, is everything okay with you? I mean, it almost sounds like he is, like, worried about Omar is involved in something.
You know, like, from talking to them, they never suspected that any of their friends were informants. So, I don't know, in that conversation, like, it just, like, he could definitely see something was amiss. Something is strange with why I'm being offered RPGs and, you know, these highly regulated military-grade weapons. And, you know, it just stands to, you know, reason that if they were planning to attack the Fort Dix military base, they would want RPGs and stuff. But they didn't want them. They said they don't want them. And then when this deal goes down for the pistols and the rifles, ultimately, which was, you know, not legal because not allowed owning them as not being citizens, you can even hear on the surveillance transcript, which there's a camera of the raid, you can hear Shane saying, well, this is great. Now we don't have to wait in line at the Poconos anymore. Right. That was actually mentioned in court, too. So these guys, from beginning to end, thought that they were getting weapons to shoot the Poconos, which they thought they'd be able to transfer legally into the names when their asylum application was finished, too.
So tell us what, I mean, we've already heard that Tartar gets 30 years in prison. What is the charge? Is it conspiracy to commit a terrorist attack?
Yeah, it was conspiracy to kill, U.S. service members. There's one thing to keep in mind in these sentences, too. The reason that the Duker brothers are in jail for life is because there's a thing in terrorism cases called terrorism enhancement, where you can, even if you don't have criminal charges before, or even if your charge is nonviolent and there's not actually any victims, the terrorism enhancement can increase exponentially the category of your crime when it comes to sentencing. So under the guidelines, to get the harshest possible sentence. So they got life imprisonment, whereas they would have probably gotten like 20, 30 years had they not had the enhancement. So that's it's really bizarre sort of tweet that the judge just chose to impose on them, which means that they'll never get out of jail. Like, barring some legal miracle now, they'll be in jail, they'll die in jail forever now.
This is just, it's just unbelievable. So these two other guys, they're in jail for the rest of their lives. What is, where does this leave the Duca family? I mean, the broader family. Who's left? There's two of the brothers go to jail, is that right?
Oh, it's three.
Three.
Elgevir, Shane, and Dratan. Elgevir and Dratan are in ADX Supermax. Elgevir is still in solitary, so literally 23 hours a day, he's in a room the size of a bathroom. And the 1 hour he gets out every day, he has to be strip searched, and then his hour out is really, he gets to stand in a cage outside of his cell, which is the same size as the cell, by himself. That's his recreation for the day. That's life in ADX, which is incredible. And Dutan is also in ADX. He's not in solitary, but he's also in ADX. And Shane is in a prison called the USP Big Sandy in Kentucky, which is a notoriously violent prison. But I guess he's the fortunate one because it's not at Supermax. So essentially their lives are devastated. And the family's life has been devastated, too. They had this really sort of successful immigrant story. They were just really gregarious Eastern European-type people. And, they're... Bareem, the only brother who was not charged because he was too young at the time, or like he was not implicated, even though he was there at all the events. He dropped out of school. He's just working two jobs to support the family. The parents were kind of older. They're raising all the kids now, the grandkids. They're being raised as though they're their own. They had this great roofing business.
How many kids did the three brothers have?
Tony had five kids, and Elgevir had two kids.
Fathers are in prison for the rest of their lives because of this.
Right, for the rest of their lives because of this. So, yeah, it's just been, awful. We've gotten to know the family quite well as a result of this. It's just such a horrible tragedy because they're just such nice people. And, I can't believe this happened to them. It's just an absolute tragedy because things were going so well for them, too. Like, just weeks before the arrest, they just made this huge down payment on all these new fleet of trucks for their roofing business. They put out these ads. They were expanding very rapidly. The families are growing. Shane was looking to get married too. And then all of a sudden, like it says in the trial, things are just a complete 180, and they're arrested on something they could never have imagined. And then that was it. They'd never leave jail again. They're going to be in jail forever, barring some miraculous legal intervention.
What is the immigrant status of the parents and the fourth brother?
The fourth brother was born in the U.S., so he's a U.S. citizen, and he's, he's here, grounded. The family, the parents, they were on the path to citizenship, and technically they still are on the path, but, since this all happened, their legal case is sort of halted, and they're still undocumented, so.
Is there any grounds, any attempt for an appeal?
Their initial appeals were just denied, and now they're filing a 2255, which is sort of a last-ditch, writ of habeas corpus based on the charge that your attorneys were basically incompetent. They had public defenders who were not very good, and representing them at trial. And that's sort of their Hail Mary last legal shot at some sort of new hearing. And, I mean, I hope that that's heard out because it's just such an egregious and horrible case. But these are not, like, high odds on 2255. It's quite rare to, you know, have a new trial based on this this sort of argument.
And lastly, you write that Omar was eventually paid $238,000 for his efforts. Bacali earned a minimum of $1,500 a week, plus seems to have received additional benefits. I mean, this is just how much of the stories that we hear in general, and I guess this may be too broad of a question to ask you, but give me your sense. Of the stories that we hear, because these stories crop up occasionally, right? And the Fort Dix Five was no different than, at least a half a dozen other supposed terrorist plots that were foiled. How many other stories do you think there are like this out there?
Well, you know, one thing I just want to add about the Bacali's other benefits too was Bacali actually was facing charges for someone. He shot somebody in Albania, and, you know, he's paid this money, and also his charges went away to Albania. He was a violent criminal who he used to infiltrate the lives of these people who were law-abiding, and his charges sort of disappeared. So, like, he got very handsomely compensated, and he's living here. His family's come here. They're all documented now. So it's a great turn of events for him. With regards to these terrorism cases generally, like, you know, it's hard to say. Like, I think that definitely a large number of them they never would have existed without the government and the government's introduction of informants in their lives, which is not to say that every sting operation is illegitimate. Of course, there are legitimate ones, and the government uses sting operations to infiltrate a wide variety of, alleged criminal conspiracies. But with regards to terrorism cases, there seems to be this very, very aggressive and overzealous, and in this case, even malicious sort of utilization of informants to create terrorism plots where really none exists. And, you know, had the government not done anything about this, had they just left these guys alone and, you know, maybe if at best do due diligence to make sure there's not a terrorist plot going on, they would still be living their lives and still be raising their kids and having their roofing business, and none of this would have happened. So I think that it's very necessary to be vigilant and skeptical and exercise a great deal of scrutiny upon these alleged terror plots when you hear them in the news. Because when they're announced, it just sounds like, oh, my God, they've stopped Osama bin Laden Part 2 in the U.S.
How much, Murtaza, does a story like this permeate the consciousness of, and again, this may be a question that is a little bit broader than you know you can answer, but give me your sense of how much a story like this permeates the consciousness of Muslims living in this country. I mean, the sort of the naivete of these guys saying, like, oh, let's just drop this video off to get copies made so we can give it to our other friends who are Muslim and have beards, speaks of a sort of a sense of innocence. I mean, how much is the consciousness of, like, I've got to be aware of everything I do in some way so that some guy sitting in a restaurant doesn't look at me and then call the FBI, and then the FBI decides, like, this is going to be the way that we're going to make our hay.
Yeah, I think that this it's in these sort of government tactics of infiltrating people's lives with informants, people who are totally, you know, not terrorists, law-abiding people. And cases like this, they've really generated a pervasive sense of fear and paranoia. I think people don't really, like, you know, there's a lot of suspicion of new people who may show up in your life. I know people who, you know, you would attend the mosque are super paranoid of anyone they may meet there. And it's sort of like generated this climate of, generalized fear and paranoia. And it could even, like, I always thought maybe this was just hyperbolic and maybe it's it couldn't actually be that bad. But upon further investigation, it's very, very widespread. Like, people are scared and paranoid. And especially if you're a slightly more conservative Muslim, you think that every bit of movement you may take is potentially scrutinized by the government.
And you'd be a fool not to, frankly, because this story shows that it really doesn't matter what you're up to at the end of the day. If they have to spend 18 months getting you to say the right word or whatnot, they'll do it. Murtaza Hussain, an amazing piece of reporting. We will link to it at majority.fm, but you can find it over at The Intercept. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you for having me.